before the practice instruction, he coined this phrase, silent illumination, which, as I was saying last night, later became, Dogen made the expression shikantaza, or themeless sitting. There's a few things I wanted to share. My response to that phrase, silence, is something that we've been talking a lot about off and on at Hokoji. And it's silent because it can't really be spoken about, this thing. We talk about it. We talk around it, I guess you could say. And so that's one element of silent illumination, is simply that you can't, it's hidden, it's quiet. There, I read something recently, I don't know if it was Trungpa Rinpoche or somebody else, talking about the experience of awakening. He said it was like giving maple syrup to a mute who had never had it before, and they can't say anything, but it's incredible. So, and the other thing about silence that I've been thinking about is that it's more about stillness than not talking, per se. And with stillness, things just, this is where, when, as we sit, things typically settle down. And the story that we carry, that we're constantly perpetuating, also has the opportunity to dissipate. And as I was flying out here, I was on the second leg. I was kind of drowsing most of the way, but these two women next to me had spent a girls' week in Las Vegas, and one of them just went on and on and on and just analyzed the whole thing, recreated it. And I was thinking, wow, she's really like holding on to that experience and making it concrete. And then I thought, you know what, I do that too. In fact, I'm doing it right now as I'm observing her. Because it's really hard to just let go and be right in this, in each instant. So that's... And then the other thing, I find that the... I'm not much of a scholar, but the intellect, we use it to describe our experience or something like that. But you can't really grasp it intellectually. You can't just think about it and have it be so. All these words and things that are passed down are somebody's, I would say by contrast, deep intuitive experience that then they use their intellect to describe. And the reason most of them do is in order to nudge us to experiencing it ourselves. And another aspect of the silence is that it's not grasping, not trying to achieve something. So we set out with some kind of urge to accomplish the way, but you can't do it that way. It's only when you stop reaching for it that it appears, something like that. And then illumination is an interesting word, because pretty much everybody speaks of light. So he's referring to the illumination of of our original nature. And seeing it. So this non-grasping insight is what we do. And it's somewhat subtle. We usually approach Zazen somewhat of an egocentric way. We're trying to experience Buddha nature or the absolute suchness, whatever you want to call it, trying to experience it through our body and mind and senses. And in some ways, it's actually the absolute is peering out from us, experiencing all this through our senses. So the first sentence of his this particular practice instruction, he says, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. And it's a lot of things in there. But on one hand, it's a kind of challenge, you know. It's saying, this is what exists. And if you already realize it, then you'll nod and say, uh-huh. And if you don't, it's a kind of this bald statement of the way it is. So the question is, what is that boundless field that exists from the very beginning? It's what everybody's seeking, really. Keizan called it luminous field. But what's interesting in reading through this, and it comes up later, is that there's no discrimination between this and that. That's the play. At first, I think, in my first time sitting for several years, the whole thing was a kind of obstacle. And yeah, as it goes along, you don't see any difference between this and your concept of what this boundless field is. In the next sentence, he says, you must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. And I mean, that's kind of our place in a nutshell there, I think. Key word in there is apparent habits. Let's see what I made a note. So this is running at a lot of levels, but two levels. One is that to purify, cure, grind down, or brush away, you know, on the one hand, it's what we're taught to do, like to counter aggression with compassion. That's purifying aggression. And grinding down, I think, is more like, in the Tibetan tradition, they talk about turning it back into yourself. Any criticisms go back to yourself. So it's that kind of grinding down. And also, quite frankly, Sangha practice is grinding and polishing. You have the opportunity to be together as a group, all with the same inclination, but all our sharp edges we rub up against each other, and it's an opportunity to purify what comes up. Or simply brush them away if it were so easy. And what's interesting about the word apparent habits is that these obstacles and ways, states of mind, are really none other than Buddha mind. It all arises from the same boundless field, in the case of this title of this one, Bright Boundless Field. That original nature is the only thing there is. So the obstacles that we create, they take care of themselves. They actually dissipate if you let them. If you stop holding on to them and allow there to be space around what comes up, then it disappears. But we have to allow that grasping to stop. As long as we're grasping, we're perpetuating our story and our wish for it to be a certain way. And then he says, the next sentence is, then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. But without, as long as we're discriminating, we giving birth to some concept of there being some division. That's our common tendency anyway. And this type of week or gathering, I think we're following a model of that's been developed over hundreds of years, and it's shifting as we apply it to this current time. But for me, anyway, spending time with my teacher, Kogan, you know, there was an energetic imprint that was passed. And it was subliminal as well as something tangible. And that's what we're doing here. And as you may not realize it, but it gets ingrained in you as you, the rhythms, the vibrations of what we're doing, how we uphold this practice, when you leave here, you can take it with you. It travels with you. The same thing, that space, not grasping, all of that is still meant to be manifested out in the everyday world. It's not just a special week that you then leave behind. Anybody have any comments or questions? Or Doug?
Grasping's pretty good for pulling weeds. Seems like it's useful.
Yeah, but are you going to grasp them all and carry them with you for the rest of your life?
Well, after you got a pile of them, it's like, what am I doing? So, doesn't that occur? Like this lady's, and I just wonder if it kind of might help prepare the field. Because then it's like, then you step, take one more step, and maybe you're there. I don't know.
But there's no preparation needed. That's the point.
But there is a cultivation needed.
Maybe.
And he calls it the cultivating the empty field. I think what you do with the weeds is you compost them. Kind of cooking so they transform. Speaking about this transformative practice. Mm-hmm. The image that I like, I enjoy all these metaphors. What is it? The circle, the last one? Is it the circle of brightness? What is it?
Clear circle of brightness.
Clear circle of brightness. What I see is the circle often in most cultures is a symbol of wholeness or completeness.
Mm-hmm.
And if I know that if I grasp on a certain idea or my apparent, whatever's, I'm separating things or making them separate, or I'm not allowing this wholeness to happen. Or seeing it as it is, already whole. Stories at the very beginning, you're talking about, oh yeah, you sit with them and they dissolve. My first thought is, yeah, some take a long time to dissolve.
Well, that's why you have to grind them down. It's like the stump. I think, to elaborate a little more, he's speaking in that second sentence. There's different approaches for, we have all these guidelines, like, the Four Noble Truths and the Three Pure Precepts and the Ten Prohibitory Precepts and the Eightfold Path and the Six Paramitas and so on. These are all tools to use, like guideposts, so to speak. But by the same time, if you approach it from the other way, when you wake up, realize your own true nature, to use a common phrase, all of that stuff is in place. So that's why you can either like grind away at it or you can brush it away. Because we have them as guideposts and all, but it's actually information that's aspects of enlightened mind that are transmitted to us to remind us or to use. I mean, they're kind of like those big Kon-Tiki statues, Easter Island statues, rather. Like, where did they come from? Huge pieces of information. But through insight into your own nature, that flash, that is there. It comes from that direction. And then we remind ourselves backwards the other way.
Yeah.
And that, in some of the Dzogchen teachings, it's like that, where you process all that stuff and you learn techniques for turning it, purifying it. But ultimately, it takes care of itself if you let it. If you don't adhere to the stickiness, if you let it go, then where is that anger now? And it may feel like it takes, like you might be angry at somebody for years, but once the instant you really let it go, it's gone. It just disappears, and it's only because that's why I say that grasping. And that grasping is goes back to the arising of dukkha, or translated as suffering, but I like the word thirst or grasping better, because it's defined also as the even high states of meditation, kind of blissful. I remember a time when Sashin felt, use Jerry's word, very strenuous. And one year, it was such a relief to be there, rather than some kind of task that had to be done. It just very natural to sit like this, you know. People looking from the outside kind of maybe think it looks strange, but it's just a very natural way to be. Koban said that in the monastery when they were young men, they used to tie their legs into full lotus at night, you know, and sleep that way to stretch them out. So you could try that.
You suggested.
No. No, but, I mean, we're not so accustomed to sitting on the floor in this posture, you know. Western people and even modern-day Japanese, no, I don't think are so much. But I noticed Koban's nephew, who runs Jokoji now, you know, his legs are very limber. He can do seizan, a dining room chair, and eat, you know, very, very limber. It's just a different... I suffer from painful knees for years and years and years. And so, you know, I think Shakyamuni Buddha developed this posture. Well, he didn't develop it, but he used it as it was a very comfortable, stable posture in which he could sit for days and days, just sit without, there was no strain anywhere. It's an antidote to gravity. And it isn't always that way for us. And so you got to find that posture. And the main thing is your position of your pelvis more than your legs, pelvis and backbone. So you have to find the right height on your chair. And I don't know, I'm sure there's people that have good advice about posture, but it's the idea is to have a stable posture with energy in your body. You know, if you go like this, it's not dynamic enough. It's kind of upright off the hips. It's what you want to keep. There's other subtle things to it as well, but there was a woman in Hokoji who was paraplegic, and she would sit on a cushion, but during Kinhin, she would lay down, and Koban had her do this laying down meditation. So there's other ways of doing it, too. We'll all be envious if you start laying down. I'm going to join you. But the idea is if you, you know, that it's... You find a way that you're awake, you know, that it's not drowsy or energy is flowing. Koban talked about the cord of energy running through your crown chakra down to your tailbone. You have to keep working with it and find the right posture.